Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When you've worked long and hard to get where you are at work, it seems sensible to steer clear of any move that might put your success in jeopardy. But have you ever considered the consequences of avoiding risk? More than half of American adults yearn for not just a job change, but a new career. But far fewer actually make the leap to something that might be more rewarding, in part because changing directions forces us to operate outside our comfort zones. Different personalities embrace or avoid risk for different reasons. But as my guest will tell us, all of us can practice taking calculated chances on small stuff so that when the opportunity of a lifetime comes along, we are ready to jump. The new book by author Ann Kramer is called Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Take. And welcome back to Think.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you, Chris.
Risk can, of course, lead to good things, but it's interesting to think about the word on its own. Calling something risky is almost a euphemism for bad idea.
Oh, it's so true, you know, and I actually hadn't locked into the notion of risk as an underpinning of or a tool that we could use as a professional aid in this new working environment until I began my research. And I realized I conducted three surveys in 2012, 2013, and 2014 to try and get a kind of 100,000, you know, mile-up view of what Americans were thinking about work. And I found that anxiety about the work and their working lives was paralyzing them in terms of taking action, but that those who had an attitude, and risk is really something about kind of planning and thinking and experimentation, in fact, would be a way I would sort of catalog it now, more than, you know, skydiving or driving over the speed limit without your seatbelt on.
You have certainly made some interesting choices in your career. Was it during this research that you realized, you know, looked at your own resume and thought, I have been a risk taker, I am a risk taker?
Yes, I mean, I certainly never set out with the intention of being a risk taker in my professional life. But I found that my own internal gyroscope for, I don't know if it would be boredom or needing something new, was anywhere from kind of 3 years to 6 years. And that led me to a variety of different fields. I've worked in banking. I worked in children's television at Sesame Street. I worked in educational publishing. My husband and I started our own satirical magazine called Spy Magazine. I've worked at Nickelodeon, and I've had a production company. But it's always been within the space of either kids, education and media, or media in a larger context.
So there is sort of a relationship between the things you've done, but they've all required you to exercise different aspects of your skills. Lots of people worry that changing jobs or almost changing careers will mean that they fall several rungs down the ladder.
I think that that is an old, almost 20th century paradigm. I mean, certainly when I started working, there was this expectation of a kind of vertical trajectory to one's career. You would start out in a junior position and you would rise up through the ranks into senior management kinds of positions and then reasonably retire with a pension of some sort. I think what we have happening in today's marketplace is that vertical trajectory doesn't exist, and that what's going on now is much more of a kind of lateral or horizontal professional kind of career path, where people are moving from different kinds of industries with different kinds of requirements, you know, from marketing into, you know, product development, and along the way accruing a portfolio of skills that they can then deploy in this kind of, you know, zigzag, as people have said, sort of permanent beta state of career development throughout their lives.
I suppose it depends, too, on the organization, but there are some places you can work where you almost get pigeonholed in what you did originally, whereas if you go across town or across the company to work somewhere else, suddenly people can see you with new eyes and have actually more respect for the same skill set.
Oh, it's absolutely true. And it's interesting, as I've been doing a lot of speaking with groups, a lot of young people, and I think it's more commonly that kind of problem is associated with young people. You start in a junior position in an organization, and then they always think you're kind of the go-to person for whatever that particular task was. And that it has been an effective career strategy for a lot of people to move between organizations in the same basic area. What I think is happening now even more so, though, is that people are changing tracks, going outside their sort of normal areas of industry and sort of taking on new challenges as a way to maintain their employability as industries, you know, are being eradicated at a kind of an accelerated speed and are being formulated at an accelerated speed. None of us really know what's going to be required of us in the next generation of jobs. So to try and keep your skills as up to date and as fluid as possible, it's important to keep them in as many pies as you can on some level.
And that also translates to the kinds of professional relationships you build. You have some interesting thoughts about networking that may be different from what people were taught in the 20th century about how to network.
Yes. I mean, I think most of us probably, you know, would join our industry sort of trade associations and go to the annual meetings and meet with people in those areas. A researcher at Stanford has been studying for a long time where people actually find their next jobs. And it's not through your typical work associations. It's through this larger kind of loosely maintained but regular contact with people in a diverse set of fields. And I liken it to, you know, if you're in a church group or if you're part of a knitting circle or, you golf or whatever it is, the people that you kind of come together with in those ways are going to be coming from different disciplines. So you might be working with a, you know, senior person in banking, and you might have another person who's working in, you know, has just started a new vegan bakery, right? But they will all have a different sort of perspective on opportunities that are out there. And once they get to know you, they can say to you, oh, you know, Ann or Chris, I heard about this thing and it fits your, you know, I think it would be really great for you. Shall I introduce you? And that's really how it is happening in this new marketplace. I think LinkedIn and organizations like that help a lot of maintaining those kind of networks. But I think it's the human interaction with people understanding what you do and what you're interested in doing that can help you far more successfully.
It seems like everybody pays more attention to LinkedIn when they're actually looking for a job than the rest of the time. So it may have some limited functionality there.
It does. I mean, I think that LinkedIn acquisition of lynda.com is a very interesting one in terms of trying to create a transition the organization more from a kind of bulletin board kind of operation into one that becomes one about lifelong learning. And I think then they might get people coming with a different mindset.
All right. So you surveyed, as you mentioned, thousands of people to get a sense of what we all want from work beyond the paycheck, right? We need to pay the bills. What did you learn?
I found that the four most important things for people in work satisfaction are feeling valued, feeling appreciated, feeling like the work you are doing for the company is recognized as something that is important. That's just the topmost thing across the board for people. It is also important for people to feel like they are continuing to grow and that they are learning new skills. You know, the psychologist, the founder of Flow, Mihaly Csizmalski, who's, I know I'm butchering his name, talks about a kind of sweet spot for people in their professional development, their life development, is when you're doing something that is challenging, but not overwhelmingly so. You do your best work. If you've been doing it forever, you get kind of bored and it becomes a stasis. So there's this kind of Goldilocks position for people in work where they feel like that what they're doing is teaching them something new, is stretching their muscles in an interesting way. And then they also need to feel like they are working in a community of people with sort of shared values and sort of shared interests. So it's not necessarily the title or the paycheck or even the field as much as it is a sense of self-worth and being appreciated.
So to the extent that maybe half of American adults, those half that express that they would like to change jobs, are not getting that at their jobs ever, or they're not getting it anymore, What keeps them from making a change? What are people afraid of?
Well, this is a really complex thing. I mean, people, there's a range of things. In my research, the two things that stop people the most are fear of failure. And that tended to be the affliction for the people slightly younger in their career paths. But then for older people, it was this fear of starting over. You know, there's this thing that Daniel Kahneman, you know, the fabulous Nobel Prize winning behavioral economist, talked about in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is, you know, sunk fallacy costs. So if you've been in a career for a long period of time, you've invested a lot. Let's say you've even, you know, you've gone to business school, you've done your training, you've been working in an organization, and somehow you're kind of tapped out. You're kind of not moving beyond. It's a terrifying thing to think about potentially jettisoning all that you've sort of invested to do something in a completely different arena. You know, we hate ambiguity. As a species, we can't stand it. Right now, we live and work in nothing but ambiguous times. I mean, you know, there was a recent study from the U.S. Labor Department that said something like 65% of all kindergartners right now are going to end up working in careers that don't even exist today.
Wow.
So we've got this, you know, we've got sunk fallacy costs. We have, you know, risk aversion. We don't like as a species being out on the tundra, you know, exposed, you know, alone. So there's lots of powerful kind of hardwired things that prevent us from doing this. And then there's the kind of psychographic pieces that are terrifying. And then we have different risk profiles at different stages of our lives. So, you know, as a young person, you might feel more empowered to take risks when you don't have potentially mortgages and or, you know, families to support. When you're in middle age, you might feel like cautious about doing that because you don't know how to code, or you don't know what's going on in some of the new, you know, technology companies. So you might be afraid of doing that, or you might be worried about, you know, your retirement plan or your pension plan as the government, you know, backup safety nets seem to erode around us. So there's a tremendous amount that is challenging for people in taking risks. And then there's families. You know, you might be with someone who is risk averse even if you are full steam ahead trying to do something different. So it's a negotiation. So it's, you know, I have deep sympathy for all of us in this world right now because it's hard out there.
But being risk averse sometimes can lead people to sort of bury their heads in the sand. And you have accounts in the book of people who just almost willfully refused to read the writing on the wall and ended up worse off than if they had sort of leapt earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think complacency right now. I actually wrote a piece for Harvard Business Review not long ago about, you know, doing nothing is the greatest risk you can take in this environment. And I think as we live in a world where tenure is being challenged in even academic universities, where government positions are being, you know, threatened, where, you know, unions no longer have the security. We don't have institutions any longer that offer us that kind of delightful 1950s sense of security with pensions. And so I think in my research, I sort of identified these four personality types. And they were pioneers, thinkers, defenders, and drifters. And the defenders were 36% of the population, and 100% of them said they hated taking risks. And 95% of them thought they'd be in the same job 10 years from now. And I think that is a grievous mistake for anybody to make, to think that they will be in the same job today that they are in 10 years from now that they're in today.
We'll talk more about those risk profiles in just a moment with my guest, author Ann Kramer. Her new book is called Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anne Kramer, whose new book is called Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. We heard there from Patricia, who says you talked about families either being in support or maybe not. Patricia says, I'm going back to school at 47 to change careers. My husband's in med school. Scary, but good. So at least they're on the same page.
Exactly.
All right. I want to go back to this, to these different risk profiles. Pioneers are just 1 in 10 of us, people who have that profile of risk interest and acceptance. These are the people most likely to change jobs a lot and also the people most likely to be entrepreneurs.
This is true. I mean, it's a small subset, and sort of characteristically of what you might think, they're the group that had the highest percentage who had only gone to high school. So it doesn't require massive advanced degrees or particularly special, technical training to take risks in your professional life. This group of people, they made 17% more money than everybody else did. So by that, at least external metric of success, they were being successful in pursuing a career trajectory. But they did a couple of things differently from everybody else. The primary thing that they did is they answered the question, I use logic and analysis to make my decisions, equally with the question, I use my gut to make decisions. And I think that this is a very important factor in terms of helping people think about knowing when and how to kind of pull the trigger and do new things in their lives or jump out of something if they've gone down a path and it doesn't seem to be working out. I think, in the last century, we developed this sense that, work is this logical place. It is, inputs and outputs and throughputs and, data analysis, and data is the king. And it loses sight of a kind of sense of fluency with the marketplace and a resonance, an understanding of timing and all the kind of emotional components that go into the making of a successful business. And I think that pioneers intuitively understand this sense that, they place a lot of chips on the table, and it helps inform, when and how to do that. In my last book, I researched emotion in the workplace, and the science of emotion is only a recent study with the functional magnetic resonance imaging machines. And what we've discovered is that you can't even decide what to eat for breakfast without using your emotions. And so it makes sense to actually value that kind of intuitive sense of timing and market and opportunity. And pioneers are particularly good at this. The other thing that they did that was kind of staggering to me was they answered the question, sometimes I do nothing at all in the greatest frequency. And everybody else says they're working 24/7. And what I think that the edge that, this kind of competitive edge that this gives to the pioneer group is that it allows them, you can't continually put out if you have nothing filling your kind of emotional or creative well. So it gives them the bandwidth. It gives them the space to either recognize a market opportunity or to think, creatively or laterally about their particular work field that I don't think others are giving themselves permission to do right now.
The majority of us, 40%, are what you call thinkers. What kinds of risk-reward calculations do thinkers make?
Well, thinkers, 75% of thinkers think that there is one thing that they are good at doing, destined to do. And this tends to have thinkers, work in fields like law and, academia, medicine. It allows them to become, executives within their organizations. But interestingly, they self-define, their highest sort of characteristics are about reliability and focus. 80% of them say they only bring their, do their best work at work. And what this led to, there were, in the analysis, there were no C-suite people in the thinker category. Now, I interviewed, anecdotally, people who were successful thinkers in the CEO thing, but I think what happens to these people, they're very vulnerable to burnout. They're the people who are like, you know, I know, Chris, you'll do the, you know, you'll do the right job. And they're there till 10 o'clock at night. You know, they're there working. They are always the people who take on the additional responsibilities. And I think that that causes thinkers, while they are gratified by their work, they're often overlooked for advancement, or they don't even see, because they're so focused in their kind of tunnel vision on the task at hand in front of them, that they don't even see that there might be an initiative starting in their organization that they should be part of, because they didn't hear about it because they were doing their job. So they shortchange themselves, I think, a bit by this kind of narrow focus.
So if you wanted to challenge a thinker to practice a little small-scale risk-taking, what would that involve?
I think that for a thinker, that the best thing that they could do is to learn a new skill, to actually try and broaden outside of that kind of self-defined one area of expertise, to do something that they are deeply uncomfortable engaging in, and see what it's like. Now, it doesn't have to be necessarily professional. I actually think that it could be a mind-expanding experience that would be good for them if they decided to learn to play the piano. I think it might be better for them if they actually might decide to try and, you know, maybe build their own website or something, to use the new tools that are out there in the marketplace to stay kind of current with what's going on.
All right, let's jump on the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hey, Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Chris. Thanks. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Hey, great. I love the show. Question that I have with the job market, especially in the North Texas area, as strong as it is, changing careers, challenges, doing it, you know, looking part time. You know, at night, you know, networking as much as possible versus saying, you know, I'm ready to resign and maybe take a month or two and see what opportunities are there full time versus trying to find part time. Thanks.
It's a great question, Paul. And I think a lot of that depends on your financial situation and your sense of your perspective employability in the area in which you want to try and find work. I think there's a tremendous amount, if you can have built up your rainy day fund in some way to allow yourself the space to explore new opportunity in a broader way, I think it can be very healthy and helpful to you. I don't think that there's any stigma particularly associated anymore in the way there used to be with looking for a job when you don't have a job. As I've been talking to lots of different groups, a lot of young people have said to me, you know, my mom always told me that, you know, it's better to get a job when you have a job, that you're, you know, operating much more from a point of confidence. And I actually think that sometimes, and particularly if you like maybe fall into that thinker class where you haven't been able to think about anything very outside the box for a long time, then it can be extremely helpful to you to give yourself the space and the time to really think through what your next step is. It also depends on your age cycle. You know, if you're 20, it's 25, it's different from if you're 45. I mean, or if, you know, if you're 55 and let's say you only have one or two more in your own mind career plays in front of you, you might want to be more deliberative about how you explore your next option. So I think a lot of it is dependent on your circumstance and on your objectives and what your skill set is and if you think you would be hard or not to get a new job.
You mentioned defenders earlier. These are the people who see work as a means to an end, typically, rather than a calling. It would seem, Anne, like defenders are best positioned to make a leap towards something that might better suit them, and yet they are often the most resistant to change.
Well, defenders were 36% of the population, and they 95% of defenders believe that they will be in the job they are in today 10 years from now. And I have to say, I think that that is a very dangerous thought to have, because truly, as I said earlier, as you know, 10 years being eradicated and everything else is happening in this kind of topsy-turvy, vastly accelerated economy, I don't think any of us can assume that our industries are not going to be affected. Even if you're a doctor, if you're a doctor and you would think, of course, I'm going to continue to be, you know, the orthopedic surgeon that I am. Well, that's all changed. So I think defenders need to create a kind of scaffolding for themselves to think about new change. 100% of them said that they hated surprises. And, you know, they all think, and prudently, you know, they have the highest percentage of people who are homeowners, but they would rather have a $75,000 secure job than ever swing from the fences and have the potential to make a lot of money in a less secure position. But I think that the complacency that these people are operating under is potentially challenging for them, because if they do get the pink slip, then they are absolutely caught without any kind of alternate ideas or strategies for how to get their next job, and that's a very challenging place to be in.
The last category you list is drifters, but there are unintentional drifters and intentional drifters.
Yes, and this is, again, a pretty small percentage of the population. It's about 14%, but the unintentional drifters are the sort of manufacturing core of the American economy, that as we all know and have seen, as manufacturing's gone offshore, as unions have lost their, bargaining power, as we've sort of seen what's happened in the knowledge economy as we've moved from the manufacturing economy, it's this group of people who have been sort of cast adrift. And it's the part of the population that I think is having the hardest time figuring out, how can they retool their skills to work in a new in this new economy? The second part of this group is, I think, a wholly new kind of condition in this 21st century, and it's a group I call the intentional drifters. And they are driven primarily by a profession of sort of self-knowledge, self-awareness. I talk about this young man who, you know, graduated from college and went to work in a nonprofit in Washington wanting to make the world a better place, and found the bureaucracies kind of overwhelming. But he'd found meditation along the way and ended up going to Boulder, Colorado to work for Buddhist Geeks, which is a tech meditation company, and then found his way to an organization in Vermont, and they just received a grant to train the police department within his town, sort of mindfulness techniques so that they could begin to handle the interactions with their community with a kind of greater perspective. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, this guy's thing has become a sort of front and center conversation in the national, you know, in the national conversation. And I think that this would be something that all communities could benefit from right now. So it's an interesting new kind of condition of work that is inner motivated, with success being defined less about place on the management tree or title or even on some level, financial. And, you know, right now, 53 million of us are self-employed, and I think a huge percentage of that self-employed population is in some way a kind of inner intentional drifter.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Anju in McKinney. Hi, Anju.
Hi there. Love your show.
Thank you. Just wanted
to make a comment. I'm 49 years old, and I just switched gears from 20 years of selling insurance to IT field. So I think there is no loyalty or long-term commitment from employers or employees' point of view. Changing jobs or skill set is as difficult as we think, or as easy as we think. It's doable, definitely doable.
So the change has been good for you?
It's good for me, yes.
Thanks so much for your call. Go ahead, Ann.
I was going to ask Anshu what motivated the change. I was really curious, to like the catalyst that had like been her trigger to help her do that.
Well, it's very interesting, and nobody was in favor of me changing gears because I was top producer in insurance line, and everywhere I went, I made very good money. But I was just tired of office politics and management, micromanagement style. So I thought, okay, let me, if I have a skill set and drive and motivation, I can be successful in any line I take. And I went back to school, did some course, and I'm very successful, very motivated, and doing a good job here too.
High five to you.
You're a wonderful role model. Yeah, great. Congratulations.
Is there a good way to tell, Anne, if we are in the wrong job, or as opposed to maybe just working for the wrong employer?
that's a harder one to answer, Chris. And I think ultimately, I believe, you know, it was interesting. There was this terrific recent National Bureau of Economics study, 2014, that found that, you know, young workers who sampled more occupations, kind of viewing each job hop as a change to discover work that was meaningful, actually made significantly more money in their 30s and their 40s. And so they've discovered that there's this real correlation between kind of a true calling and a higher income. And I think that you can be a square peg in a round hole in an organization. Let's say you have a particularly kind of ebullient, demonstrative personality and you're working in the insurance industry or the banking industry. That might not necessarily be a good emotional fit, but you might be really, really great at accounting and numbers, right? So it could be that it would be important for you to find a job working in a more relaxed environment, again, a tech startup, an entertainment company, you know, where that kind of personality behavior was a better fit, and you could still employ this thing that was, you know, that you're really, really good at. It could also be, though, I wrote a piece for Harvard Business Review a couple of years ago about what if you don't want to be a manager? And the normal way you reward people within organizations now is that you just sort of keep promoting them into levels of management and you take them away from the work that originally gave them satisfaction. And I think that, you know, that could be an indication of like being put into a job that you're not a good fit for, and that if you could find a way to get back closer to the thing that was a calling would be helpful. And I think In this new economy, which I think is being ever more challenged by individuals who believe that they can be the masters of their own destiny and kind of have agency in the direction of their careers in a way that they're never used to be, successful employers will figure out programs to retain their employees.
We're speaking this hour with Ann Kramer, whose new book is called Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Ann Kramer about her new book, Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. We have one here from Alex who says, could you speak about, you mentioned, for example, going from marketing to project management. However, I found that in order to procure a new position, you have to have experience in that field. If people are afraid of failure and change, how does one go about entering a field that's new to them when employers seem to want a job candidate with experience in the position for which they are applying?
Excellent question, Alex. And I have to say that my daughter is going through this right now. She's 27 and is looking for a new position in within her company that she's been integral to. And they said that they required 5 to 8 years of management experience. And she was reluctant to even apply for the job. And I basically said to her, well, I think you really should give it a go because, you know, your knowledge of the company is an asset and what you've done is an asset. And she works in a tech company that has in the food industry. And at any rate, so she did. And I think that the important thing to do is to it goes back to what I was talking about earlier about that kind of sweet spot between trying for something that is a challenge. I think it's incumbent upon you, if you are applying for that position, to frame your work experience in a way that tends to answer the kinds of questions that you think that they are asking. So you need to look back through your professional working life and isolate the things that you think answer that experiential question. If, in fact, you actually don't have anything close to that and you're thinking of making a change, then I think it would behoove you to identify the precise thing that you think is lacking in your skill set, and either go and take, you know, an online course at something like, you know, lynda.com that LinkedIn just bought, or find a course in your community college, or, you know, even this Seth Godin, who's this sort of interesting innovator who I have a profile in the book about, has just started something called Alt MBA, where you can do this online course and get a kind of different kind of MBA period. So I think you can find the skills that you're lacking and supplement them if you really want to stretch for the job and you don't seem to have them right now.
An email from Celso asks, do you think today's employers are risk takers? And do you have any advice for those looking for new career directions on getting employers to buy in? Is there anything beyond you getting those skills for yourself? Are there things you can say to people that might want to hire you to convince them to give you a shot?
I think it always has to originate from a position of self-knowledge, you know, of deep analysis around the company you're looking for. I was always kind of stunned when I was an executive that people would come in and want to interview for a position and have not done the basic work about, you know, the companies that I was working in, and have a basic knowledge of the competitive set or the competitive arena. So, you know, if you're wanting a job at Nickelodeon, what is going on in children's media and publishing and entertainment? What are the competitive forces? What's happening? Do your homework. I mean, that is just a given to me. So I think that can give you an edge when you're going in for a job interview, because you can assume that a lot of your competition looking for that same job will not have done the homework that you have done. And that will then inform a series of sort of questions. And then, you know, a wonderful woman, I wrote another piece a while ago about this young woman named Zanel Mutapfa, who was a young student at Portland State University. And she wrote 2,000 people a note trying to get an internship. And she'd gone online. She had three very clear things she wanted to try and do. She wanted to either become a plus-size model, work in, you know, media, or be a kind of woman's advocate. And she wrote to all the people she could find within that space. Of the 2,000 people she wrote, 50 of us wrote her back. And of those 50, six of us agreed to meet with her. She's just that kind of person who was able to kind of not take personally the rejection of the 1,950 people who didn't respond to her email. But then she also interned at Adidas and, you know, decided that she was just of her own volition going to create her women's empowerment message. So she put together a video and a kind of website and a blog and a presentation. And she went into the people and said, you know, I'd like to do this for you. And they kind of looked at her and said, yeah, this is kind of awesome. So I think, it sounds like I'm putting a lot of the burden of this on you versus on the employer. But I think the people in the hiring business are right now overwhelmed. They don't have time. They don't have time to read. They don't have time to think. They're in meetings all the time. If you can make it easier for them, I think you will be better served in getting a job if you do that.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Jessica on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thanks.
I am just going through this existential crisis right now. I've been working for the same company for the past 10 years, very successful at it. It's allowed me or afforded me the ability to have a nanny. I can work from home on certain days. But with the recent news going on, Charleston shootings, the pool incident in McKinney, I just had this burning desire to make this world a better place for my 8-month-old son. So my goals have completely shifted. I feel like I want to throw in the towel some days and just go run and work for a nonprofit, be it Planned Parenthood or something to help children with education just move up in our society. And I'm wondering, is this going to phase? Is this just hormones for being a new mom? Or do you think I'm really at a crux in my career where I should make some important changes?
Thanks for your call.
Jessica, I think you are really at a crux in your career. And I think that this ties back to that listening to your inner heart, your inner intuition, your gut. And I think it can be a very powerful motivator. I think as part of it, you need to do all the due diligence of, your financial housekeeping. And really map out if you're going to make that choice. You clearly will not make the same kind of income you've been making in the past. So what is your nut? How are you going to manage it? Have the conversation with your husband. You know, really treat it as if you're doing a kind of business analysis, of what you want your future to be. and then explore the various jobs that you could go into. But I think that something powerful is speaking to you, and I think it's an admirable thing, and you should listen to it.
What do you say to people who, and maybe this is the defenders again, who don't think they're going to change industries, but people who don't think it's possible for them to be really happy at work? We know lots of people sort of long for something better. Other people just assume work is a slog and that's the nature of work.
I think there are kind of different kinds of people, and I think it's perfectly fine to be a person who says, you know, I can't remember which great American poet worked in the post office and then went home and wrote the poem. I mean, I think it's perfectly acceptable for all of us to make decisions in our lives saying, I would much rather have a kind of job where I know I can be home every day and have dinner on the table for my family or make it to my soccer games or actually, you know, become a, you know, triathlete or whatever the trade-off it is that you're making. Everything in life is a trade-off, and it's how we kind of weight those things. And it ties back to this, sense of life is just this kind of journey where at each stage of your life you need to kind of check in and have self-reflection. And then create the valuation scale within your own life to decide what's the most important for you.
We have an email here from Rebecca who writes, my husband is definitely the pioneer type. He's currently in a career change and going to school for his PhD. I'm much more in the defender group. I feel constantly barraged by him to take risk, but as the sole provider for a family right now, I just can't figure out how to make any kind of move. I want to learn from his mindset, but just feel overwhelmed by his risky style. What are some things to learn from pioneers?
Well, I think in that particular instance where you have sort of two different types, I think just experimenting in ways large and small to kind of create what I call almost a risk practice. So that, you know, if there were something that you were interested in exploring and you didn't particularly have an idea how to start, is there a place where you could have a cup of coffee? Is there a community group that you could kind of connect in to do it? I think there's this really cool book called How to Be an Explorer, I think, of the World, and it has nothing to do with work, but it's all about learning to see the world with kind of fresh eyes and intimate ways, and it's fun, and she has tons of different sort of exercises that you can do that begin to kind of unleash the more creative side of your brain and help you loosen outside of it. Another tactic in this particular instance, if you're the sole breadwinner and you've got somebody else getting their PhD, which could be a long process, would be to, you know, sit down, have the conversation and really create a contract and say, well, all right, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z during this period of time. But then when you've got your PhD in the job, it will be my turn. And so you create that kind of tag team through life ability to have periods of each person having the ability to have periods of sort of exploration and experimentation.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Nancy on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Nancy.
Hi. I have really enjoyed this conversation. I'm a ventriloquist, and I've made my living as a ventriloquist for 25 years this year. And I just want to say to young women, especially who are coming up, you can do it. You can live your dream. And you may not live I've got plenty of retirement and I've got plenty of health care, but I have lived my dream for 25 years and I would not change it for anything.
Thanks so much for your call. Anything you want to say to that, Ann? Ann, are you with us? Okay, it seems like we may have dropped our guest here. We will bring her back in just a minute. We're speaking this hour with author Ann Kramer about her new book, Risk Reward, Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. You're listening to Think. Back now with my guest, author Ann Kramer. Her book is called Risk Reward. Sorry about that, Ann, but I'm glad we have you back.
Good thing we weren't in the middle of brain surgery, right?
Exactly. A regular old telephone line will rescue us for the last couple of minutes.
Fabulous. So
the last thing I wanted to ask you is what all of this suggests about the way we approach higher education, which I think since the time you and I went to school has gotten more and more focused on career preparation and almost like job training as opposed to a basis for a number of potential paths.
Yeah, I think, you know, I believe that, you know, good old liberal arts education does serve one well because I think it teaches one kind of creative problem solving and critical thinking skills. And I think you can't underestimate the value of that. And I think that in many ways is far more important than understanding, you know, something specific about a specific industry that may not even exist a year from now or when you actually enter the workforce. You know, I closed out my book with a conversation about Sandra Bullock and Gravity and kind of how she was problem-solving and pre-forming her way into solution after solution after solution. You know, that to me is the model of education we should be pursuing, which is teaching people to think and to think critically, you know. I mean, I think that would resonate with you and your show.
Absolutely. Do you feel like writing is more than just one career for you now because you look at so many different aspects of the world and the way we move within it?
I do. And in fact, I write often to find out what I'm thinking. But interestingly enough, I'm in the process right now of trying to start a new business, which is in sort of the decorative objects area,
wow.
in a market that I'm seeing slightly underserved right now. So, you know, who knows what next will be?
Watch this space. Well, I'm sure you will be successful. Thank you so much for being with us, Anne.
Thank you so much. It was a real thrill to be back.
The new book by Anne Kramer is Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. We had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.